Recordings have started. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone, to our meeting number 13 on the CCWG on enhancing ICANN's accountability on February the 17th at 6 UTC. So, as usual, our roll call will be led or stated as for the people present on the Adobe Connect room. If there's anyone else that is present in our call and is not logged to the Adobe Connect, please kindly state your name now so we can add you to the roll call.
Cheryl Langdonore, not in the Adobe Connect room. I'm good, but I can't actually drive and Adobe Connect at the same time.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Anyone else that is not on the Adobe Connect but with us on the audio bridge?
Somebody needs to mute. There's an echo.
There's an echo indeed. All right, so if there's no one else on the audio bridge that is not present on the Adobe Connect room, I will kindly remind you to update your SOI. We've been receiving many SOIs on the email list, for which we are thankful. And if anybody else is missing the update of their SOIs, of course, please feel free to contact staff in order to continue updating your SOIs. And with no further delay, I would like to turn it to Thomas for our agenda point number two. So, Thomas, please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Leon, and hello, everybody. This is a very early time in the day for me, so it's a little bit difficult for me to speak. I know that others in other time zones have other challenges to meet, but I think the good news after having returned from Singapore is that I'm still in very good spirits about the outcome of our Singapore meeting. We have heard a lot of very positive feedback in the public forum. Steve Crocker has mentioned that he's heartened by the fact that we're making good progress. So there's been a lot of good feedback from all sides, basically, very little criticism. So I hope that this group can actually keep up the momentum. We are working against a very tight and aggressive deadline. We only have a couple of weeks, I should say 5 weeks, before we plan to have our next face-to-face meeting. So I think what's key now is that we adequately organize our work to be able to work preferably in parallel and not sequentially, so that we can place the burden or share the burden on many shoulders. You will remember that we were struggling a bit with the demarcation between what we called WP1 and WP2 at the first working session we had in Singapore. The co-chairs then sat back and thought of ways to facilitate the demarcation and also come up with a proposal how we can best structure our work to be able to deliver without creating any overlap. And that resulted in the cookbook analogy with the cartoons that you will remember. So basically, we have proposed to the group that we would use four ingredients out of which accountability mechanisms and escalation procedures could be created. You will remember that these were principles, an empowered community, the board, and some sort of independent appeals mechanism. And that we would compose the accountability mechanisms out of these, which would fall into two groups, i.e. triggered and non-triggered accountability mechanisms, and that for each of those accountability mechanisms, we would work on a standard template that we'll get to in a minute. Well, this sounds all nice and easy to write up a cookbook that would encompass all the accountability mechanisms. But actually, the devil is in the detail, and we have corresponded with our able rapporteurs, Jordan and Becky, on how we could best slice the work so that we can come up with results timely. And so I would like to turn it over to either Jordan or Becky or both to share their views on that with us.
Well, I don't know if Becky is here, so I think that leaves me. This is Jordan here. Can everyone hear me?
We can hear you all right.
Okay, thanks. Look, Thomas, the logic that you set out in terms of the words have escaped me. The two categories that you put out of triggered versus non-triggered powers or mechanisms. From our conversation in Singapore, Becky and I think that we should basically try to make that work. That there is a kind of conceptual distinction between things that happen as part of normal ICANN processes, like being able to approve or disapprove a budget, things along that nature on the one hand as a kind of non-triggered mechanism, and things that get triggered by the community or some part of the community because of an action of ICANN or because of a lack of an action by ICANN. So things like removing board members or the board or instigating an independent appeals panel process. So we think that that the starting point would be to work through those divisions. And if it doesn't work out, if it doesn't make sense to people, then we can readjust later. But we think it's probably going to be workable at this point. And the pledge that we've made is that we'll keep in very regular contact, more than weekly. Probably we'll try to attend or at least pay attention to the meetings that each of the working parties has. If there's overlap, we'll make sure we reshuffle things back into only one of our working parties working on them, and we'll try and pursue the same deadlines. And by the time we come to our face-to-face meeting, the idea would be that there's a full menu of these powers and mechanisms as per the template that's been circulated and is for discussion in the next item. So that's all that I have. I don't know whether Becky's going to be here or not. And if you want me to say any more about any aspect or if there are any questions, I'd be happy to deal with that.
Thanks, Jordan. I guess the question that I would have is whether you are okay with the number of volunteers that have joined your group, or shall we ask for more volunteers to join to share the burden?
Thank you for that question, Thomas. The last time I looked at the list on the wiki, there were around about 40 people on it or so. And I'm just trying, the reason I sound like I'm speaking very slow, I'm just trying to find the current list again. And it looks still like there are a good 30 to 40 people on it. I don't think we've got any problem with the number of volunteers on these groups. And the distinction between triggered mechanisms, which would be Becky's working party two, and non-triggered ones or planned ones, which would be working party one, is largely consistent with the way that the topics had already been distributed. So we think it's likely that most participants will still feel like they're already in the right place and that there are plenty of volunteers in both working parties. I haven't specifically discussed that sufficiency of resource issue with Becky.
Okay, thanks. There has been a question in the chats regarding definitions of members, participants, observers, and now volunteers. The distinction between members and participants and observers relates to the joining of the CCWG as such. So that has nothing to do with volunteers now joining these subgroups. So both members as well as participants are welcome to join the subgroups, WP1 and WP2, to work with them. The status of observers remains unaltered, so these are more than welcome to join and listen in, but they can't actively participate. Jordan, I guess my final question to you then would be to share with the group the time and date for the planned call, which, if memory doesn't fail me, is planned to take place this Thursday. Also, as a reminder for the whole group, you will remember that we've also used the analogy of developing this in an agile mode. So we will have it would be the best use of our resources if we had smaller teams working on the individual items in parallel and then actually check the interim work results on a regular basis so that we know that we are fully aligned on the outcome and that we can adjust if need be on a very timely basis. So with that, I think we can move to the accountability mechanism template. Those that have attended the Singapore session on Thursday, either in Singapore or remotely, will remember that we presented to you a template that can be used to work through to sort of set out the basic parameters for accountability mechanisms. So this is basically the form that will be used both by those working in WP1 as well as WP2 to further define the accountability mechanisms that need to be defined, that can be existing accountability mechanisms that have to be altered or new accountability mechanisms that we will recommend to set up. Since you've seen the some of these questions on a slide, during the Singapore session, we have refined this a little bit more. The goal of today's call, or one of the goals of today's call, is to get feedback on the questions or the categories of questions from this group so that we have an agreed version of the template that we will use as the basis for further work. Now, this is not, you know, some might say, okay, we're talking process again. I think this is not process, but this is substance. In fact, this is the basic strawman that we use to have a standardized approach to working on accountability mechanisms. So this form, and actually you have scroll control, so you can go through the document by yourself, is grouped into various categories. So we have the description of accountability mechanisms first. So you would jot in the name of the accountability mechanism that you're working on, a quick description. You would categorize it because, as you will remember, we have checks and balances, we have review and redress. So you would identify into which of these buckets the very accountability mechanism would fall. You would also specify whether it's triggered or non-triggered. You would speak to the potential outcomes of the accountability mechanism. Is the outcome to approve something? Are you asking for the board, let's say, to redo a decision or to amend a decision? So what is the ultimate goal if you use the accountability mechanism in question? There is a second area relating to standing. So who can actually invoke that procedure? Who has standing? For what can you get standing? You know, we discussed the question of, staff decisions at a quite low and that these should not be challenged with the big stick accountability mechanism, let's say, to remove the board. So that's something that needs to be given some thought. Then we will have to work on the standard of review. So we will need to talk about process, principles, other standards, what purpose of accountability the mechanism contributes to. You will remember that we added a big why to our work process or to our thinking so that we are in a constant feedback loop, so to speak, to ensure that we are always cognizant of the purpose that the accountability mechanism serves in the overall accountability architecture. Then we would need to talk about the composition of a decision-making body. You will remember that we were quite clear in Frankfurt that there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all decision-making body because we have different areas of expertise that are required for different areas of of decisions. So we would need to speak to the question of skill set for the decision makers. Do you want the decision makers to come from different geographic regions or from different stakeholder groups? What interests should be reflected there? You know, there should be gender balance of some sort that would also need to go in here. And if you add the number of persons or the number of representatives or delegates per organization that can send somebody to this decision-making body, then you can form a decision-making body. You would also need to speak to the question of whether independence of the decision-makers would be required. We could think of certain decisions where it is a good thing to have, let's say, the decision-makers being delegates from certain SOs and ACs in the ICANN ecosystem. Let's say when it comes to budget approval, it would be good to have people from the community and not necessarily people from completely outside. And in that regard, you could even have binding votes by these delegates based on instructions by their respective organizations. While in other cases, it may be desirable that we have complete independence and that there are no interests reflected in the decision-making body. And also, how should this body make decisions? What would be a voting threshold? Would you need 100% of the vote, 75%, 60, 40, whatever the voting mechanism might be? Then we can move on to the last item in this category, which is recall. That's basically to ensure that the decision makers themselves are accountable. So there, we need to think of mechanisms to recall decision makers in case they don't work adequately. Then it comes to decision making. I think I spoke to that already, just double checking. Yes. And accessibility, that would be cost, that would be time, so that people can actually rely on the process not to be delayed for many, many years, so that they can get access to affordable accountability mechanisms, that they can get results in a foreseeable time span, and also that we need to think about inclusiveness in terms of languages. So what languages should be available to use accountability mechanisms? And we also need to speak to the question of implementation measures. So, for example, if we spoke about the ICANN bylaws or ICANN policies as one vehicle for accountability mechanisms, then there are certain time spans that need to be factored into the process. So we would need to specify what times likely needed to draft new language for the bylaws and then to ultimately get that decided upon by the ICANN board and then actually entered into the public register. In Germany, it would be the commercial register, but I'm sure that there is an equivalent in the U.S. where we would need to have that entered into, and that would also take time. And that point, I think, is particularly crucial. It's always been on our radar in terms of project management to factor in implementation times. Now that we're in a phase of actually operationalizing or designing accountability mechanisms, this is the time to come up with concrete time spans for that. And for those that have attended the Singapore sessions during the GAC session with CWG, Larry Stripling made it very clear that he wants to have information on implementation. So we shouldn't underestimate that. That definitely needs to be part of the package. So with that, I'd like to open it up for questions from the group. As said, ideally we would use this template at least as a starting point. to base our work on. Jordan rightly pointed out that we might need to tweak this a little bit based on the work in progress, but nothing's carved in stone as of yet, so we are flexible as we move along. But we want to ensure that we have agreement on what we have now. I see two hands raised in the chat, and the first to speak is Steve.
Steve Del Bianco with the CSG. I have a comment and a question on this cookbook template. The last item is implementation, and my comment is that ought to be the place we indicate which aspects of implementation should be done prior to the IANA transition versus those that can wait until after the transition. We've often described this as work stream one and work stream two, and you could use those terms at the risk of confusing people, but this would be a good place to address how much of the implementation, if any, has to be finished before IANA transition. Any feedback on that, and then I'll move to my question.
Yes, I guess, Steve, my immediate answer to that would be that what you're asking for is a value judgment as to whether it should go into Workstream 1 or Workstream 2. I think I would leave that value judgment to a later stage, because we may as well be in a position where we see, okay, this is a Workstream 1-related item, but the implementation time is going to be so long that we can't do anything more than just committing ICANN to implementing it rather than having it fully implemented.
And it might well be that the part of implementation that is Workstream 1 could be the part that it gives us the power to force acceptance of a bylaws change if it's supported from a bottom-up consensus. So let me move to the question. If you scroll up a little bit in the document to the section on the decision-making composition, it says composition. You talk there about the composition of the decision-making body, and I wanted to point out that a number of our mechanisms can be invoked by the community itself. So in that case, the community makes a decision to trigger a referral to an independent review panel. In that instance, it's the community that we have to talk about its composition. Is it going to be a cross-community working group, members and delegates, or some sort of a structure? And then separately, the independent review panel to whom the decision is referred has issues of composition. So when I saw your block of composition, I'm wondering whether you're thinking of the body that we refer the decision to or the body that makes the initial decision. And there are instances where a decision like whether to approve a bylaws change or an annual budget, they don't go to an independent review panel. So in those instances, the composition is the community, however we constitute the community. Go ahead.
Yes, I guess that for, let's say, budget approval, you would need to think about how the community makes itself heard. I think, you know, that could be by means of a standing or ad hoc cross-community working group. So you would use the template in that sense. When it comes to areas where the independent review mechanism is invoked, then I would place that in the standing section, where you would need to define what group of SOAC representatives, of community representatives, can actually have standing. So then it would not be the decision-making body, but and for independent appeals or review mechanisms, you would need to think about the decision-making body and its composition in that very section. But the composition and how the community actually gets to get this mechanism triggered would go into the standing section. Well, this is me thinking out loud here. You're certainly right that in these two-phase processes, one might be able to use another type of template, but I think that the way I described it, we could use this template and stick to it. Does that answer the question, Steve?
It does, Thomas, but I am endeavoring to try to keep things simple, especially after what we saw in Singapore with regard to the CWG. And there are a number of triggered mechanisms like bylaws and budget where we thought that to make things simple, bylaws and budgets affect the entire community. So whatever we come up with as the quote-unquote community would be deemed to be composed properly, because we work awfully hard at defining who our community is, and we needn't then address any of these questions in the cookbook about the community or skill sets or anything else. The community has a bylaws change that the community, by whatever supermajority or majority threshold we determine, then that community is deemed to have competence in understanding whether a bylaws change is appropriate or that a budget is appropriate.
By all means, I would still put that into the standing section for the very reason of keeping things standardized and simple. But nonetheless, the answer to the standing questions can be a little bit more wordy than in other areas. So you can specify the group of community representatives and how it is composed to have standing to approve a budget or request bylaw changes in that regard. I think at the moment we should try to stick to a standardized form to work on these questions, but nonetheless the question of community representation, how it is composed, who delegates whom to this committee is an important one that, at least in our report, I guess will need a lot of explanation. So we,
and George, I
guess
what
we
answer for me too.
Excuse me, say that again. We were cross.
I wanted to wrap up and move on, but I see in the chat that Jordan Carter suggested he has an answer for the questions I'm raising, and Jordan runs this work party, so I'm happy to defer to Jordan on that. And I realize that some of these questions can't be answered right now.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve. We will get to Jordan. He's in the queue already, but let's first go to James.
Thanks, Thomas. James speaking. Can you hear me?
We can hear you all right.
Thank you. And thanks for your overview, and thanks, Jordan, for putting this together. So I have a growing sort of unease with one part of this that I wanted to share, and I think we can fix it fairly simply. But just generally, while I am in favor of a variety of robust accountability mechanisms, as a business interest, I'm concerned that there are that we may be inadvertently creating an environment of uncertainty for business-related decisions. So, for example, I can think of if a specific TLD were determined to be delegated, and then there would be accountability mechanism one would be invoked to undelegated a TLD, and then another accountability mechanism went to appeal the reversal, et cetera. It could drag things out for months or years. So what I'd like to see at some point here in the template, and perhaps it belongs in the first box understanding, is some explicit review of the limitations or exclusivity of an accountability mechanism so that it would not be used to perpetually revisit and review existing decisions. So, you know, I don't know if that's something that we can put into this first box here of where it says type of decision being challenged, whether or not other accountability mechanisms have already run their course, whether there's some sort of statute of limitations for employing an accountability mechanism, or whether, you know, a certain mechanism would be off limits to address certain types of decisions that were already impacting products or businesses that were already launched. So, I don't know if this is making sense, but I really feel like there's a certain point we need to foster an environment where there's some predictability and certainty so that, you know, businesses can go ahead and proceed with a product launch or TLD launch or something of that nature without concern that there will be years and years of appeals revisiting those decisions.
Thanks, James. Actually, this is a point that we tried to reflect, obviously, too superficially in the conditions of standing section, which reads conditions of standing, i.e. last resort type of decision being challenged. So that is the section where these caveats or limitations should go into. I think the
Thomas,
point
that's exactly where I was thinking this needs to be as well. So I think we're thinking on the same page here. That's exactly the box I was looking at.
So I would suggest, James, and I guess this might ease the pain of others with this form, is that we will work with the rapporteurs and ensure that we have one test case, as we did with the stress test, to see how this form works, evaluate that with the whole group, and amend if needed. And we will pay special attention to the point that you raised, i.e. to ensure that we have the correct remit and the limitations of the accountability mechanism reflected in the conditions of standing. Next is Ellen.
Thank you very much. My question is quite close to Steve's, but perhaps a slightly different flavor. As Thomas, as you are going over the list of possible compositions, I started fearing that, you know, we might end up with a different group or a different composition for each different accountability mechanism, and I think we really want to try to keep this as simple as possible. External appeal panels may be composed differently based on the subject matter, but I would hope that the internal decisions all come down to one thing, whether it's members or representatives or whatever of the community, and not try to try to tailor everything to each particular mechanism to the state possible. That being said, I would really like to, and maybe I'm jumping ahead of the game right now, but I would really like to see, to the extent possible, that whatever the community mechanism, community composition is, that it not be a body that's a quasi-board, but actually reverts to the communities itself to make the decisions. Otherwise, we're going to have to end up with an accountability mechanism to check the accountability of this new community group, and that's a never-ending tale. And my last comment is, you use the term, maybe this group is a CCWG, a standing CCWG. I would really caution against using that expression. The CCWG has a meaning within ICANN, which includes, among other things, typically open composition and open participation. And I think we want to be careful, and I would suggest we adopt some different word so that it doesn't sound like it's a CCWG-type mechanism. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And very brief responses to your last point. I was just picking up one of the ideas that had been voiced to implement accountability mechanisms, and we have delegates, membership organization, and then also mentioning of standing or ad hoc cross-community working groups. So I was just using what the community or this group had previously suggested, but your point is well taken that this is a defined term in the ICANN ecosystem. With respect to the first point, we've heard this question before, that the solution needs to be simple and that we will that we should avoid fragmentation of different community groups for different types of questions. And we surely agree with that. However, we are of the opinion, and we as co-chairs have discussed this quite a bit, that we need to go through the exercise of looking at the individual requirements first to then make sure that we have looked at it from all angles, right? So ideally, we would be able to come up with a one-size-fits-all community representation of whatever shape or form, but we as a group need to write a report. We need to explain to the outside world that we have given due consideration to the question of composition to respond to the various community empowerments that we have listed. So I think we need to do the exercise of specifying the needs for the various community asks, and basically it's that what we're working on, and then hopefully we're going to be able to marry that all into one consistent body, maybe with different voting thresholds for different types of activities, but the idea is to boil that down to one solution as we move on. Jordan is next.
Thank you, Thomas. I think we could all agree that if we end up with different bodies with different rules and different compositions and using different standards for each of the 3 or 10 or whatever community powers that we decide are needed, we're going to be creating an absolute nightmare. We'll be creating a mess, a system that the community can't understand, that won't hold ICANN accountable, that will make everything worse. So I think that was the logic with respect about the previous division of the working parties, that you should separate the powers you were trying to give to the community from the mechanisms that would implement them. But there is also, you know, there are numerous ways that you can slice and dice these issues. So I think we should proceed as we are, and I think what will happen is that the first part of the template, in terms of the description of what the power is going to be the most important, because we need to very carefully specify that. And I hope that we can get to a single institutional mechanism that is embodying the community, as Steve said. And then I hope that other things that we do will be amending or using existing bodies or processes with a common set of standards or principles on which this is all based, a la Becky's first draft. So I guess I would just caution us, and hopefully we all agree that where we're going to get to is simple, but the process of getting to it is going to be and look messy. And there's no way to avoid that if we're going to be able to show the community that we've done an appropriate level of due diligence on all of these questions. That's all.
Thanks, Jordan. I'm David and then Eberhard, and I'd like to close the queue afterwards so that we can move to the next agenda item. David.
Thank you, Thomas. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you all right.
Thank you very much. I would like to, since we're working on this template, to mention up in the description the possible outcomes. My comments are along the lines of James and some of what Jordan was saying, and it has to do with limitations. And I think that ironically, to keep the process simple, this document, this mechanism, may actually have to become a bit more verbose. What I'm getting at here is we should specify, probably in this section or somewhere else, potential remedies and limitations on remedies. And in that respect, let me just mention, I'm happy that Bruce is on the line, because I'd like to mention a conversation I had with Bruce in Singapore on the Sunday, just after the Sunday meeting. Bruce said that the board had discussed the these mechanisms and had some receptivity to spilling the board and pulling the AOC into the bylaws with certain, but the devil was in the details. And afterwards, I asked Bruce if the board had also discussed the ability for panels to address questions of substance and whether decisions could be binding. And he said, and Bruce can correct me if I've got any of this wrong, they had, with exceptions, and they were open to it with exceptions. And I asked for some examples, and he gave me two. And he said, if a panel issued a decision that said, ICANN had to take certain action that would violate applicable law, they simply wouldn't do it. That seemed reasonable. And secondly, he said if the panel issued a billion-dollar award, they wouldn't do it. That seemed reasonable. But it opens the question to remedies. And I'm certainly happy to work on this. I'm on the WP2, but I think we should get more detailed about remedies and limitations on remedies. And I think the detail will help us keep the whole process simple in the end. Thank you.
Thanks, David. And I guess that point should go into the possible outcomes, which are approval, redo, amendment of decisions, I guess we will take your point to heart and ensure that for each of the mechanisms that we discuss, we have a very clear vision on what the remedies should be. Next is Eberhard.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thanks. As I have said already in Singapore, and I find this is all getting too complicated for me, I think we're going about this the wrong way. If something is wrong with the ICANN board, we should fix the ICANN board. And creating additional layers will only create additional layers of bureaucracy and additional layers of accountability issues, and then we have not more layers and more layers. So that part of my concern seems to have been heard. But I think we are looking at this in a too small way. We should go for the larger picture and go for a bigger reform of ICANN and the ICANN board.
Thanks, Eberhard. As you will remember, this group has not been chartered to review the ICANN board, but to look at things from a more holistic point of view. I know that you made this point in Singapore and in other fora. It is well noted, and I think it's a reminder for us that we need to pay special attention not to create additional complexities unless they are inevitably needed. I think what we should be doing now is hear oppositions, as we just heard from Eberhard. Otherwise, I would take your non-objection as your consent to move on working on the basis of this template. We would also make sure that we have one test case ready as soon as we can, so that we can evaluate the usefulness of this template and adjust if need be. And with that, I would say we move to the next point, which is the expected results. And as you will remember, I said at the outset that we have something in the area of 5 weeks before we plan to reconvene in a face-to-face meeting. So we should make sure that we work within this time frame to get all the bits written up and to even review and hopefully improve on some of the interim results before we get there. So I guess that when it comes to the expected outcomes, I would like to turn to Jordan again. Jordan, I know that Becky is not on the call, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but have you given feasibility some thought?
Yes, I have. And I think that we've got about 5 weeks, right? And we'll want to get materials to ourselves in time to be able to read and think about them before that. So we need to close off the documents 4 weeks away. In terms of my working party, I think that what we've got to do is get the five or six mechanisms, the five or six powers that we're after down pat, and then to work at the templates through. And to answer Avery's question from before, my assumption, and if I'm wrong, someone should tell me, is that it's down to each working party to structure its work as it sees fit to fill those out, and that in the ideal world, what we'll see at the face-to-face meeting is a series of these template documents filled out, one for each name of mechanism. And there'll be a set from my working party that are about the non-triggered or planned powers, and there'll be a set from Becky's working party that are about the triggered ones. And as we review those, we should realize that there'll be some similarities in the things like the composition of the deciding bodies and so on, and we'll be able to hopefully refer to a much smaller list of bodies like that. But in terms of developing the content of those templates, I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to do that and get to either a good level of consensus or good clarity about the divisions in the working party in time for that meeting in Frankfurt. And the reason I'm confident about that is that I know that if I was just going to write these myself, I'd be able to do it in half a day or so to get some drafts ready for people to discuss. And if I can do that, then a working party of more than me can do it even better. So I think we're going to be fine. And I've just seen every asking the rest of us don't get involved until review. Obviously, everyone is able to participate in those working parties. I'm sure that the documents will be made available transparently in ways that encourage comments. So from my point of view, we'll be as open as we can.
Well, that's very good news, Jordan. Thank you so much for that. And with that, I think we can close this agenda item, and I'd like to turn it over to Mathieu.
Thank you, Thomas. Maybe just I had a last question for Jordan, that making sure I think it'd be great if we can have regular sneaks into the progress you're making in the working parties within the whole group, so that we get familiar with these templates being filled on a regular basis and have some discussions, so that there's no surprise effect when we come into the face-to-face, but rather than in the face-to-face, we can focus on the outstanding issues, such as the one we discussed, the simplicity of the community mechanisms, which should certainly be in line with each other, or any difficult topic that would come up where we wouldn't get consensus right away. So I would hope that we can, at each of our calls, for instance, have, just like we're reviewing the stress tests, review one of the interim work product from the working parties within this template. And if that's possible, then it's certainly going to help us educate us as well as help us identify the key issues we have to solve. Jordan, do you think that's feasible?
I think not only is it feasible, but it's absolutely essential. I don't know if we're planning weekly meetings of this group or not, but my plan is to keep WP1 meeting after the meetings of this group, to get some work done on agreed deadlines, and then to render that all available through documents that accept comments and so on, and then to circulate a brief note to the CCWG list, just identifying what's been done and including links so that people can easily follow at each point. And I think Matthew's suggestion about working through some of the substance on these calls is also good, particularly if we start with ones that are likely to be more tricky or controversial, to give people most time to think about those ones.
Thanks, Jordan. That's for me is the closing of this item regarding work party 1 and 2. Many thanks to Jordan, Becky, and all the volunteers who are going to work on this. And now we're moving to the stress test group. I know Cheryl is driving, and Steve is here. So you will remember that on Thursday in Singapore, we started reviewing we did 3 stress tests to ensure we had a form of agreement on the assessments that were proposed by the working party. And so you have the document, which is now on screen, which you can follow. So the first stage would be, and I will hand over to Steve or Cheryl, to ensure that we are still in agreement on the interim assessment we've made of whether the stress test was adequately covered by existing accountability measures or by our so far not completely defined proposed accountability measures. And then I will suggest we go through the remaining 2 or 3 stress tests to do the same exercise as well. Steve or Cheryl, would you take us through maybe I can do the ones that have already been reviewed. I can just call for any last-minute thought on number. So the number 14 was the termination of affirmation of commitment, and we said the existing measures were inadequate, and the proposed accountability measures would be adequate. And if there are, Jordan, I guess it's an old hand, if there are any last-minute thoughts on this. So I'm moving a bit to stress test number 16. I suggest you you have control over the scrolling bar on your document. 16 is ICANN engaging in programs not necessary to achieve its limited technical mission. There have been some, Steve and Cheryl have very kindly taken into account the feedback that we had on this, on the wording in this stress test. And the current assessment is that existing measures are inadequate and that the proposed measures in combination may be adequate. So we would have to obviously review that because there's a need for a combination of mechanisms to cover this. Any other comments on this one since Thursday? No. So I'm moving to number 18. Number 18 wasn't discussed last time.
That's over to Steve then. It's Cheryl here. I'll go back on mute.
Yeah.
Steve, seeing as I have little control over my mouth, well, I have that at the best of times, but due to anaesthetic this time, if you could take us through 18 and the other two, if possible, if time permits. Thanks, Steve. Over to you.
Yes, just before turning to Steve, I think we have discussed the number 5, which is a little below, I think it's on page 4, during our meeting on Thursday, the one regarding the financial crisis. Or was it, which one was the third one? Steve, maybe you can help me out here.
Yes, I believe we tackled number 22.
So it's a failure to comply with bylaws or refusal to accept a decision of a redress mechanism. And there has been some... this one we did not really close the discussion on, right?
We were pretty close because Roloff, if you recall, suggested that the very bottom corner of number 22, that...
Yeah.
If the proposed measures are adequate because the community still has the power to spill the board, the so-called nuclear option. So this reflects the discussion that occurred Thursday morning in Singapore.
Yeah. Exactly. So maybe we can try and close this one and then move to the other ones. So this one has existing measures that are inadequate. And the... proposed accountability measures, the proposition by Roloff was the proposed measures in combination are adequate because the community has power to spill the board. And we would remove the initial wording from which was relying on the fact that the board takes seriously the threat of being recalled. Is there... Any comments, objection on this?
Yes. Cheryl here. Just because of how we did not actually make a call to the room to actually get that as a yay or nay, I would suggest you take today's meeting as a first reading and pick up your second reading at your next meeting, okay?
Okay. So 22 is first reading, and with the new... wording, which is at the bottom of the at the bottom right corner, and does this reading raise any concern or objection? Okay, so we will consider 22 to be agreed at first reading, and we'll review it at our next meeting. Izumi has a question. Please, Izumi. Izumi, are you on mute? Izumi, we cannot hear you. Athena, are you trying to come to Izumi's help? Izumi has a problem with her microphone. Athena, you're next on the line while Izumi types her question. Athena? We definitely have problems with the mics. No, Athena, we cannot hear you either. And I promise we're not trying to censor the ASO here. I can hear something now. Is it so the question from Izumi is what exactly we are agreeing at this stage? So the question, what we're agreeing on is on an assessment of whether the existing measures do cover the contingency, so whether they're adequate or not, and whether at this point the yet not fully defined proposed accountability measures would be an appropriate response to the contingency. So we are not confirming agreement on specific measures. We're just basing our assessment on the idea of community powers, the ones we identified in a mind map, and the review and redress mechanisms as discussed in the mind map out of the Frankfurt meeting. So that's in order to ensure that, one, whether our requirements would improve the contingency management, and second, whether we would still have some remaining gaps to fill before we are confident we have proposals that are adequate to be proposed to the community and the board and then the NTIA. I hope that covers your question, Izumi. Apparently, yes, if I'm reading the chat correctly. Avery, you have a question.
Yes, thank you. Avery speaking, assuming I can be heard. I guess I'm having trouble, and I had the same question, I think, as he, but maybe not because she was satisfied with the answer. In other words, we have, it's very speculative into the proposals, and they haven't gone into depth. So I'm wondering, in terms of agreeing with the analysis, to what degree are we actually agreeing that they have the solution correct? Or are we just, and that's the part that I'm very fuzzy on, because I'm fine to agreeing that something, you know, not that I, and you know, that something is an issue, and perhaps even to a preliminary analysis that the existing measures are adequate or inadequate. But I have more difficulty with the proposed accountability measures at this degree of specificity. So I'm not sure. Thanks.
This is a very good point, Avery. I think it's extremely clear that our assessment of the impact of the proposed accountability measures is still very dependent on how it's going, they're going to be defined, and the idea, the global idea that we would have, we need to be confirmed. Therefore, everything on this on the right-hand columns are going to be have to be reviewed after we have really defined our proposals. But the added value of this process, and And I'm very aware that we're talking process again, but I think it's necessary so we are comfortable with it. The added value is that, as I said, number one, this is going to help us identify some missing parts where the ideas we came up with in Frankfurt are not yet covering the contingencies or mitigating the contingencies we identified. That's number one. And number two, it's also going to help us stress exactly what the requirements we identified, how they will actually improve ICANN's accountability. If I take number 22 we're discussing right now, it's clear that this analysis enables us to say basically why we need these, because they're necessary to ensure that the board complies with the bylaws or accepts decisions from the different redress mechanisms. So it's not a final agreement. It's definitely not going to be the final word, but reviewing these is a very helpful exercise, and actually it has a lot of relationship with Work Party 1 and 2. As we'll see later, I think we will have some very valuable input from going through this. But it's not final in terms of course, as long as we haven't specifically defined the accountability measures, it cannot be held to be final. Alan, you wanted to add something?
Yes, thank you. It's Alan speaking. My question was very close to Avery's, but I'll state it not as a question, but as my view of this. What I think we should be doing right now is looking at this essentially as a sanity check, saying, is there anything wrong with the logic that has been proposed here, number one? Are there any, and when we finish it, are there any accountability measures that we decided to implement but haven't used? And obviously, if we find in any given stress test that can't fix the problem, can we fix it by adding a new accountability measure? But I don't see the need to sort of formally say we all agree on this. I think we should just be going through this, noting any problems with it, and because we're going to have to do the really detailed review once we actually have invented the accountability mechanisms.
Okay, so Cheryl here.
Faster path.
Yeah,
Cheryl,
Cheryl here.
Do you want to reply?
Thank you. Yes, I do. And I'm going to lose connection briefly because I'm actually in my driveway now. So if I do, can you get them to call me back on the landline? I see this, in inverted commas, agreement as agreement on the current state of the text with current state of the process. So what we're doing is taking it through a set of drafting exercises. It does everything the text says, but rest assured, we have to go through every single one of these, hopefully in a fast track, not finding stuff that we'll have gone through at this early and provisional stage. So this is a provisional exercise. Anything you're agreeing with is that the current state of text reflects the current state of situation, and absolutely nothing more. So once the mechanisms are there, and we've added or subtracted, as Alan outlined, then, of course, the whole lot, at least as far as that, those outcomes, those bottom boxes, have to be gone through again. And to help people understand that, I will do something in terms of colour on the wiki space to make sure people know that this is still highly provisional outcoming. Thank you.
Thanks, Cheryl. I hope everyone's captured that. There's one part of the confusion that would come from the fact that the columnist labeled what CCWG accountability measures, and it's while it's really the stress test against the proposed accountability measures, and we really not trying to get into too much detail into defining these. We're all fully aware we'll have to review this after we have specified. So what we should definitely be doing through this exercise is assessing whether we all agree on whether or not additional actions need to be taken, or whether or not the accountability measures, as we are now looking at them, are actually helping with a specific contingency. No problem in being maybe a little lightweight on the agreement call, so that it remains flexible. But I think it's worth reviewing this. It seems to be, Carlos, I don't know if you can, if you have voice or only chat, but you raised on the chat that you wanted to add something regarding one of the other stress tests we've reviewed. Okay, so we can come later if you're able to. My suggestion is, I think we've been discussing 22 sufficiently now. I would now turn to probably Steve, I guess, to lead us through the other stress tests we have in the document and we haven't been discussing so far. Which one would you like to start with, Steve? Because you've added recently number 18.
That's right. Let's go to 18. It's new. We put it in today, and it might be worthwhile. The rest of them we have all talked about at least once. And again, this is only 6 of the 24, 25 that we have to put together. So if you scroll in the document to the item read stress test 18, this is with respect to the GAC advice to ICANN's board. This stress test came originally from the BC, and it was in response to so much concern by critics of the transition who worried that governments would get too much power in a future ICANN absent the NTIA's tether through the IANA contract. The stress test scenario is that the GAC would amend their own operating procedures so that their advice could be arrived at by a simple majority or a supermajority, as opposed to consensus, which is what they use today. And again, that is an operating procedure, number 47, operating principle number 47, that is within the GAC's complete control. Neither ICANN Corporation or the community have anything to say about the GAC's internal operating principles. They can change them with a simple majority vote that they take over 2 successive meetings. This stress test predicted consequences that could be rather dire if a simple majority of governments in the GAC at any given meeting were sufficient to approve consensus advice. You could well imagine some very different outcomes than the advice we've been seeing so far. I mean, at a few GAC gatherings, there have been as few as 60 or 70 governments present, so a majority would be as few as, say, 34 or 35 GAC members. If they all agreed on something that was sufficiently important to governments, it could actually put a severe restriction on free expression or some other form of valued ICANN principles. So when we look at the existing accountability mechanisms, the ICANN bylaws give due deference to GAC advice, giving it due consideration, including a commitment to try and find a mutually acceptable solution. So it is not a requirement that ICANN board accept GAC advice, but it does give due deference to advice on the assumption, I think, that it's consensus advice. Now, today, GAC adopts formal advice according to its own operating principle 47. The consensus is understood to be the practice of adopting. I can't read it now. It suddenly got smaller. Grace or Alice, are you controlling the Zooming, or do we have independent control over the Zoom? Thank you. So consensus is understood to mean the practice of adopting decisions by general agreement in the absence of any formal objection. And under that principle, we're probably okay. But as I said before, the GAC at any time can change its procedures to some other form of threshold, a lower threshold for what constitutes advice. Folks, I do want to remind you, this is about the bylaws. This isn't about the applicant's guidebook for the new GTLD program. The new GTLD guidebook specified things for which GAC advice could be given, and it had procedures for how ICANN's board reacted to that advice. But that was advice specifically targeted to certain applications that were coming through the new GTLD program. Right now, we're discussing the general provisions in ICANN bylaws under Section 11. So now turning to the third column, the proposed accountability measures. Well, one of them we've discussed many times, to give the community standing to veto a board decision so that if the board acquiesced to GAC advice, took a decision on that, and it was not supported by GAC consensus, the community veto could enable a reversal of that decision. And to Avery and Allen, we're using, at this preliminary stage, we're using words like community standing to veto a decision. We are deliberately trying to use community empowerment requirements at a very high level, such as we've discussed in Frankfurt. We are not trying to use very specific words to describe the mechanisms that Jordan and Becky are putting together right now. But as all of you understand, this is a first look at the high-level empowerment, high-level review and redress, and not a detailed look. We'll have to come back and do that later. So I added one in here that comes from the inventory that was prepared 7 weeks ago out of comments that came about 7 months ago. And it was another proposed measure to amend ICANN's bylaws to give due deference only to the GAC consensus advice and add a definition of consensus. By doing so, that measure would ensure that if GAC were to change its operating principle to switch to majority voting, that that wouldn't carry the kind of due deference the consensus would. So this is an element of a defensive maneuver, I guess I would say, because we're defending the ICANN process from being captured by a simple majority of governments in the GAC by saying ahead of time that the only advice from the GAC, which is given the deference that we have today, is that which comes as a result of consensus. So happy to stop there, Matthew, and take questions. This will have some implications since Jordan's work party would need to dust off that bylaws provision and bring it into the list of items for either Workstream 1 or 2. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I think that's where we're going into substantial discussion, because the exercise is suggesting and leading you to suggest is to add another requirement into our Workstream 1 package, which is one that we haven't discussed in terms of consensus in Frankfurt. James, you had a question, and if there are, I'm particularly interested in GAC reactions to this, because obviously it's very much related to the GAC as well. James?
Thanks, Mathieu. James speaking, and thanks, Steve, for teeing this up. I think this is possibly, I don't know if it's the most important stress test, but it certainly ranks fairly highly in my priorities. So my question, and I posted it in the chat, is if we amend the bylaws that only consensus advice needs to be considered by the board, then isn't the GAC free to determine what mechanisms it uses for establishing consensus amongst its members? Could it just simply say that simple majority, 50% plus one of attending GAC members constitute consensus? Or would they be accepting of an external definition of consensus to mean a supermajority or no objections or something along that line? I'm just concerned that, I think we're on the right track here, but I'm concerned that we're leaving some loopholes in place.
James, this is Steve. If you take a minute to read it in the Adobe, you'll see that the way we designed the stress test is exactly the situation that you just described. We described the fact that the GAC can change its operating principle, which currently requires consensus, but it can change it themselves without any input from the community, and they can change it to majority voting. And that is why the proposed measure of amending ICANN's bylaws says that whatever the GAC does, if the GAC advice is not consensus advice, then it's not given the due deference and a promise to find a mutually acceptable solution. So this is inoculating the ICANN bylaws against the possibility that the GAC might change its own operating principles in the way you just feared.
So Steve, and maybe I'm just not getting my head around this, but if we were to put this in there and say something along those lines, that this is the board only considers consensus advice from the GAC, and then the GAC would say, well, this is – I'm sorry?
Yeah, the part of the bylaws that I'm referring to is Section 11 of the bylaws for ICANN, and in there it describes GAC advice as – carrying over the obligation of the ICANN board to give it due consideration and to try and find a mutually acceptable solution. And that is what I mean by due deference. I think that ICANN's board can consider GAC advice anytime it wants, but this formal obligation to give it due consideration and try to find a mutually acceptable solution, that is the deference level that I think we should reserve for only the advice which comes from the GAC as a consensus, as opposed to any other form of GAC advice. Go ahead.
I don't disagree with you. I'm concerned that as long as the GAC gets to set the threshold for determining what is and what is not consensus advice, that this still leaves the ball, you know, in their court. And that unless it's codified explicitly in the bylaws that consensus is supermajority or greater, let's say, that this is still kind of a floating target.
You're exactly right, and that's why the solution is that this stress test identifies a hole in our current set of solutions, and that hole gets plugged if you reach back into our inventory from the summer and change the ICANN bylaws now. So we change the bylaws so that whatever GAC decides its consensus won't matter, because the ICANN bylaws only give due deference when the GAC advice was arrived at through the consensus as we define it. And I would put that definition in the bylaws. I would use the same definition that the GAC uses today, where consensus is understood to mean the practice of adopting decisions by general agreement in the absence of any formal objection. How's that sound?
Yeah, I like it. Thanks.
Got it.
I think the important thing is to take the definition external from the GAC, and I like that.
Yep, and that's exactly what's on that Adobe. I don't think you have visibility of the Adobe because that's what's in there.
Okay. I have Alan on the line, and I note some of the discussions on the chat regarding options on the one side, but also how it would be appropriate or not to specify very much in detail some of the items regarding the GAC. Alan, you lowered your hand, or are you still on?
No, I'm still on, but I wave it. I think we're going to need to discuss some of these concepts about unilaterally setting what the GAC considers consensus.
Well, Alan and Matthew, I think you bring up a great point, but let's keep in mind that we're not going to try to impact how the GAC does their business. But we're going to say to them that if you arrive at advice through consensus, we're going to give it the special due deference that's baked into Section 11 of our bylaws. Today, we don't specify that it's only consensus advice that gets that due deference. So we change our bylaws, which is an incentive for the GAC, that if they really want to get the due deference that they want, they had better try to find advice that can attract the consensus of the governance. We're not telling them what to do. We're just telling them that if they do it a certain way, we'll give more consideration to their advice.
And my point was deciding what the GAC treats as consensus. Right now, if you look at the CCNSO and GNSO, they have different definitions of consensus, and we honor them. My point is we may not be in a position to decide that for the GAC, but I don't think that's today's conversation.
Right, but keep in mind that the definition that we use in the operating principle of the GAC is the GAC's own definition of consensus today. That's their definition, not ours,
mm-hmm.
And I believe they got it from the United Nations. So it comes from good stock.
Steve, I think we must be aware there's a lot of discussion within the GAC about what consensus should be, and it's not uniform.
All the more reason for us to define the kind of consensus that deserves to override the bottom-up process.
But my concern right now is that our proposals have to be approved by all chartering organizations and be consensus. And I think we're touching here something that's very sensitive to many within the GAC and outside the GAC. And I think that's the point you're raising is extremely important, because this stress test is designed because there is a requirement that the transition could not happen if an organization would be in the hands of several governments. That's the starting point of this contingency. So we need to find a way to address this. But I think this is, and we'll certainly have to look at whether we have agreement within our group to add something along the measure you're suggesting into our Workstream 1 package. Yet I don't think we're fully ready to do that yet, because we haven't had any much feedback from the GAC, and we should certainly highlight this early on to the GAC members that this is a question that's coming into the table. I see that Thomas wants to add something.
Yes, and that's just to say that we have a lot of GAC members in this group, and I think we should tap on their expertise. I think we are all here in order to make ICANN a better organization, and that everybody, including GAC members, wants to ensure that we preserve what we will likely call the basic principles for ICANN, including openness and avoiding takeover by individual stakeholders. So I think we should try to get insight from inside the GAC, and I would encourage the colleagues on the call and in this group from the GAC to work with Steve on this very topic, so that we can ensure that we don't create a we against them situation, but it's actually trying to safeguard the organization against contingencies, as unlikely they might be.
Yeah, the action item I would along this line, I would take from this discussion is we should definitely reach out on the list, but specifically to the GAC members, to point towards this stress test conclusion, ask for their input, and then review at our next call, have a substantial discussion on this at our next call, so that we can consider a decision whether or not to include this into our Workstream 1 package, based on these inputs. So we should definitely take that one step further, engage with the GAC, and then review the decision that is being suggested by Steve and the group. Would that be okay for you, Steve? I see you have your hand raised.
Yeah, thank you. One final comment on this. If we were to decide that it's too on the nose to add a bylaws provision requiring our definition of consensus, then I would point you to the very top corner on item 18, and that is the fact that all of us have felt that the community needed to be empowered to override a board decision. So frankly, if the board received non-consensus advice from the GAC and acted on it, we have already agreed that we wanted to have a community veto of a board decision. So that general power is already there. There's already an opportunity to stop the board from acquiescing to a piece of GAC advice. That's what the community would be able to do. Now, the GAC is a voting member of the community, but it certainly doesn't constitute a majority and doesn't have a veto of its own. So our endeavor here is both belts and suspenders, as opposed to a general veto by the community. its belts and suspenders to also propose a bylaws measure that most people would probably think makes sense, in that the deference that the bylaws give to GAC advice should describe the kind of GAC advice that was thinking of. If everybody assumes it was consensus because that's what it's always been, well, then go ahead and lock that in so that the GAC can't change from consensus to something else. And I do want to remind everyone that an excessive influence by government was one of the chief fears behind many in Washington about the IANA transition. So it's better for us to take this head on and work out a solution that our GAC colleagues will agree is sensible. If we were to ignore this one, as Eric and a few others have said, we ignore it at our peril, because I don't think the transition would proceed without an answer to this stress test. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I think you're right to remind us that that's the point of the whole contingency and the discussion. Let's go to what I suggested is I think probably what we can do in relation to with you, Steve, and Cheryl is engage with the GAC members. Maybe inform Thomas Schneider as well as in order to ensure there is as much information circulated, that we have this discussion, that we're having this discussion. There are options and scenarios, and we need some form of informal and non-committing input, but at least some participation to this discussion, so we meet the requirements set up front by the NTIA, no excessive influence of governments, and yet keep our, come up with something that's going to be acceptable for every party within ICANN in order to improve the system. And I think there's been some ideas floated around in the chat as well as during this discussion that should certainly help us find some form of solution, but we need to address this. So action item is for... probably the co-chairs with Steve to engage with GAC members on this, and then we come back at the next meeting as one of the discussions we need to keep going. Is that okay? All right. That was an important point of discussion, and I think it stresses really well how this stress test exercise is valuable to our work right now. I'm looking at the other stress test in the group, in the line, but the financial crisis we've discussed already at our meeting on the Monday in Singapore. Steve, would you like to take us through 19?
We don't really have anything on 19 yet.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry. We do. And we probably haven't been through it yet. I do want to be conscious of the time and the other elements on your agenda. 19 will not be trivial. How much time do you want to allocate?
I think we could have 10 minutes on this.
Whatever you want.
As a first reading?
Okay. All right, folks, scroll down to item 19. We have not discussed this publicly yet. Cheryl and I circulated it on Saturday, the first Saturday in Singapore, but hadn't discussed it publicly yet. 19 is distinct from stress test 21. 21 specifically addressed a CCTLD, revocation and assignment. This is about a GTLD. So the stress test is described as if ICANN were to attempt to redelegate a GTLD. Let's say it's one of the new GTLDs and the registry operator was in breach of its contract and ICANN decided to redelegate. Let's suppose that the registry operator challenged the action in court and got an injunction from a court someplace. I think this presents a real dilemma for ICANN because the entity that's charged to do root zone maintenance, which today is VeriSign, I don't know who it'll be in the future, would face a question of whether to follow the ICANN redelegation instructions, or to follow a court order. Now, under the present agreement with the U.S. government, the entity that's performing root zone maintenance is doing it under contract to the U.S. government, and they're protected from lawsuits because it's publishing a route for contract with the U.S. government. But at the end of the IANA stewardship transition, it may result in the root zone maintainer, whether it's Ferrosign or not, that root zone maintainer might likely no longer be a party that's operating under a contract with the U.S. government, and it therefore would lose that protection from lawsuits. So ICANN, I was reminded by Samantha, is bound to follow appropriate court orders from courts of competent jurisdiction, and I acknowledge that. But it seems to me that the existing measures may not be adequate to make it clear that the root zone maintainer is either following ICANN's instructions that have been arrived at through policy, or it is doing so subject to court orders. And I'm no lawyer, but there are plenty of lawyers on this call and within the ICANN community that could probably have a field day with this one. And when I turn to the proposed accountability measures, I don't think it would protect the root zone maintainer from lawsuits. But one proposed solution is a community could challenge a management decision and refer to an independent review panel with the power to issue a binding decision, so that if ICANN took action to redelegate the GPLD, the community itself could invoke an IRP. The registry operator could invoke an IRP, and the IRP from a standing panel could reverse that decision. And that is doing it without resorting to the courts. Now, the true question about court interference with ICANN processes probably has to wait until the CWG decides whether the counterparty that replaces NTIA for the naming functions contract would be an internal entity or an external entity, and if so, what kind of protections could it provide from lawsuits? So we really can't answer this one just yet, but this contingency is rich with opportunity to explore the right solutions to make sure that a disgruntled applicant doesn't gum up ICANN's works, but at the same time give registry operators adequate redress through the review and redress mechanisms like an IRP. So, Matthew, I'll stop there and take questions.
Thanks, Steve. That's quite an interesting one. Sam, do you have anything to add?
I guess I have a question about this. I know we had a little bit of back and forth before this was published to the list among the smaller groups working on this, but I have some larger questions about accountability mechanisms that are, I guess I don't understand. Is there a suggestion that the accountability mechanism would require ICANN or if ICANN was also in the root zone maintainer position, it required them to do something in violation of a court order? I'm really not clear where the accountability mechanism tie in with court action.
No, I think the point that Steve is making is that the question is what kind of accountability mechanisms or systems could be set up that would protect ICANN against a law, a court decision being issued against ICANN. Of course, if a court decision is issued against ICANN, then it's perfectly binding. There's no question about this, but that's probably not what
This stress test is about a decision against the root zone maintainer, which is currently a third-party entity under contract with the U.S. government, and that may change. We ought to look at that with both eyes.
So, Carlos, wants to raise a point. Carlos, yes? We can't hear you. Maybe you're on mute. Maybe you have a problem with your mic. You have. Maybe while you're fixing it, I can move to Alan. and if you solve it, then hopefully we can get back to you later. Anand?
Thank you. I have a couple of concerns or maybe just confusions about this particular scenario. My understanding, it was IANA that makes the changes, and the root zone maintainer just follows those instructions. So I'm not sure that part of this is applicable. But the larger part I have with this scenario is, my recollection is, and it may, Samantha I'm sure can correct me if I'm wrong, that the registry contracts specify binding arbitration, and I thought preclude court actions. But that latter part I'm not sure about. But if that's indeed correct, then this scenario doesn't apply. There may be other court injunction scenarios that apply, but I don't think this one does.
From the new GTLD program, they're thinking. I believe that they have agreed to go to arbitration, but that would be against ICANN. In fact, this scenario, this stress test, is about a party that is neither ICANN nor IANA. It's a third party, which today is fulfilled by VeriSign. It's a zero-cost contract where they act as the root zone maintainer under a contract to the U.S. government. But that's not ICANN, and it's also not IANA.
Steve, it's Alan. I understand that, but I'm not sure the root zone maintainer has the ability to do that. I'm not the expert on those functions.
And this is Sam, just to interject on the contract issue. We do have binding arbitration requirements, but I think that there's also a separate issue that there's always a possibility that someone who's not under contract with ICANN would could come in with a suit challenging either the delegation or redelegation of a new GE or a CCTLD, or a legacy G, any TLD, actually. So I'm not sure that the contract referral to binding arbitration covers the whole possibility of where suits could or challenges could come from.
Point taken.
Okay, so now let's move to Avery.
Yeah, thank you. Quick question. I think, Samantha brought out the beginning of my concern. For example, in the new GTLDs, if there was a state that wanted to challenge the delegation or what have you of a GTLD, how would that be dealt with? Is there something that deals with international jurisdictional arbitration of some sort, or how does one deal with that? Thanks.
Thanks, Avery. I think you're raising the point that Jordan is also raising on the chat, that the question is not only whether there should be a court order within the jurisdiction ICANN are operating, but also a conflict of jurisdictions in other countries. And I'm not sure what this exercise shows is we don't have full clarity about what kind of scenario we would be discussing and how it would play out. We don't have full visibility about the actual risks and consequences or even the way to mitigate this risk. We don't even know what would happen today, actually, if some court order in, say, any other country than the U.S. would say that a specific action by ICANN would not be acceptable. We don't know what the chances of this, that the court would consider itself at the grants, the standing, and everything. My feeling is that we are in front of an international jurisdiction issue, and we would probably need to get some general view about that matter. And what I'm actually leading to is we've engaged very recently with the latest advisors appointed by the public expert group. Lee, the international law expert, Lee Bagru, and that's probably a question we could ask him to consider how it would play out, whether the how he would phrase this contingency, and maybe if there are any protections that can be put in place. I think that's very much an international law aspect. Samantha, you wanted to react to that?
Yes, thanks. There clearly is an international aspect to where a judgment might come from and how it could be enforced in a different place, but I think that this is actually a far more fundamental question, which is, what are we trying to solve for? Because a court order, assuming that it's enforceable, what are the accountability measures that we are suggesting could be put in place that would address an issue around a court order, and who is obligated to follow that? I agree that maybe having the advisors look at the stress test to see if maybe they could help flesh it out a little bit more might be helpful, because when I look at this myself, I don't necessarily see that there's a way to propose accountability measures that address a need to follow a court order.
Thanks, Sam. I think that's the ideas I'm pointing to, fleshing this out so we get more clarity. Steve?
Yes, thank you. Keep in mind that these were written by the BC back in May of 2014, prior to the separation of transition into two tracks, the CWG and CCWG. And this question, probably, as I indicated in the bottom right-hand corner, is really one that needs to be looked at by the CWG as well, because the CWG is deciding whether to do functional or structural separation, whether to have mechanisms for separability. And if you separate the naming function from ICANN, because they're not doing it well, well, folks, you have to understand, you have to also separate the root zone maintainer role from ICANN as well. Those would probably both be considered what the CWG is planning. And I fall back on the status quo. The status quo is not a question of international law at all, because the entity that's doing the root zone maintainer role is doing it under contract to the U.S. government, and therefore it is not subject to being sued, no matter what the international law is. That immunity means that it is purely a technical execution function and can't be interfered with. However, that if that's subject to change, and that's why I started that line with however, the IANA stewardship transition might result in root zone maintainer not operating under a U.S. government contract. And if so, how would you then provide the same level of protection from injunctions or lawsuits for the root zone maintainer role? We can pretend this is not an issue. We can pretend it's not an accountability issue and just punt it over the wall to the CWG. But I'm not at all confident that they're looking at it yet either. So it's been worth 15 or 20 minutes of our time to dive into it. But if folks are scared of going here, well then maybe we won't. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I'm going to close the queue so we don't have to finalize discussion on this. It's good that we have this discussion because it's highlighting a very important aspect. Sam, is it an old hand? Yes, it was. Ebrot, please, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
First of all, nobody is immune to lawsuit. If VeriSign does this on a contract to the government, then the government is the party that gets sued. Secondly, if it's not a matter of international law deals with multilateral agreements between countries and organizations that are established by treaties between countries. It deals exclusively with 253 or whatever national jurisdictions and legislations. Courts can reach everybody they have got jurisdiction about. It depends whether ICANN has whether a national court decides it has jurisdiction about ICANN. And it courts like to decide whether their jurisdiction is by way of whether they can reach somebody, whether they've got property or whether they have got any other ways of so that judgments can be enforced. If this is the case, ICANN is subject to the national law of whatever country where this is the case, and we can discuss as much about immunity. Nobody is above the law. If a court decides it has jurisdiction and it can enforce this jurisdiction, it will force ICANN to do whatever the court wants. And because in some countries jurisdictions are quite harsh, this is something very seriously to be considered for such stress testing.
Thank you, Everett. I think the distinction that's being drawn is between international law and cross-border law, and we're probably more into cross-border law. Thomas, a final word, and then we'll wrap up to the next items.
Thanks, Mathieu. And actually, I think your suggestion was a wise one to place this question in front of the independent advisors. One point I'd like to go on record with, though, is that at least in Germany, DNIC has been given not immunity but legal privilege by courts because of the fact that the German government has recognized their role or the role that they're playing. And if memory doesn't fail me, I think IRA Magazine also mentioned that part of the reason why ICANN is protected is because the U.S. government has recognized ICANN's role. So maybe we should, as a placeholder, put into the document that we need to work on two things. Number one, clarifying with legal experts or independent advisors whether a recognition by national government does help, and if so, how we can actually reach out to governments through the GAC or otherwise to ensure that ICANN in its new role gets as much recognition by national governments as possible to get as broad protection as can be. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Very important point, and we'll certainly have to include that into the investigations. Everard, is that a last word you're requesting? No, it's an old hand. Okay. So conclusion, interim conclusion on that item, and once again we're seeing the value of the stress tests, is we'll try and engage with the external advisors so that we get some input about this particular stress test, the cross-border law issues, and how exactly we could get some way of mitigation of this contingency. And I'm not speaking about immunity because it's technically probably impossible, but how we can get mitigation of this risk, maybe including some recognition from governments if that's helpful. And that's something we would need to check. Very interesting discussions on those items. And I think we should encourage work party on stress tests to keep on pressing these stress tests, because they're obviously pointing us into directions we have not been fully considering so far. So it's very promising, and hopefully we can keep doing that in the next meeting. It's better to highlight these issues up front rather than find them out at the end of our work. I am now going to turn to the next agenda item, which is an update on the timeline, and I would turn to Barry for a very short update on this while it's being brought up. And, of course, that includes the key question of our next face-to-face meeting coming up. Barry?
Thank you, Mathieu. This is Barry Cobb for the record. So I believe everyone here is familiar with this visual diagram that we have of the CCWG's timeline to deliver a draft proposal ready for public comment and then, of course, review the public comments and prepare a final proposal to submit to the chartering organizations and ultimately to the ICANN board. This particular visual hasn't changed much from what you may have seen at the Singapore meeting. However, there are a couple of small light adjustments, and I'll just draw your attention over to the left-hand side. There's a few bullet points that will tease out our key deliverable dates. As what was mentioned earlier by Thomas as well in the chat, there is a face-to-face that is scheduled for the CCWG on the 23rd of March and 24th of March. The location is yet to be finalized, but we hope to have more information by the close of this week as to what the exact location will be, as well as hotel information, etc. Noting that the 23rd of March is the start of the face-to-face, and as Thomas mentioned, we basically have 5 working weeks to prepare content and ready for that face-to-face, as well as pretty much at conclusion of this week, we whittle down to 4. You'll also notice that in the month of March, we do have what is listed as a blue circle item, which is highlighted as a possible tentative high-intensity session. It's likely, if this is needed, it will probably be conducted remotely. So this is really just a TBD as we get closer across the 2 remaining work areas and 2 work parties as the work advances over time. What this ultimately means, though, is that we have set a target date to launch a 30-day public comment period for 6 April, and this is the slight variation from in this diagram that you might be able to notice if you've memorized the previous one. Originally, we were scheduled for a 1 April launch of the public comment period, but as you'll also know that there is both the CWG and the CCWG are working on similar timelines to prepare their documents for public comment. And at the close of the Singapore meeting, all the chairs had met, and it was determined that post the public or post the face-to-face meetings that there will be additional time needed to ready those documents and finalize their preparation for the launch of the public comment. So with that in mind, basically, at the conclusion of the face-to-face, the CCWG will have 12 calendar days to ready that draft Workstream 1 proposal to ready it for the public comment period. And then, of course, after the public comment period of 30 days, they will approximately have 2 weeks to review the public comments and, in parallel, 3 total weeks to finalize the Workstream 1 proposal, which is our most important date, which is the 20th of May, and that's to submit the final Workstream 1 proposal to the SOs and ACs that give them 3 weeks to approve that proposal to ready it for delivery to the ICANN board. And do note that, which I believe has been discussed some on the list as well as at Singapore, is that there's still a question as to how the GAC may need time to approve the draft proposal as to whether they will look to do that in Buenos Aires or, if possible, an intersessional might be a possibility as well, but that's yet to be determined, and we'll know more as we advance closer into March and April. So I think all in all, that's about the review of the timeline. I should also note that the 23rd and 24th is when the CCWG is meeting. We're leveraging the same location for the CWG to meet at the end of the week as well. And then the Wednesday will be a transitional time frame in which the chairs of both groups will meet so that there's proper coordination going on. And again, just to reiterate that we don't have we have a short list of locations. We don't have a precise one met yet. It is likely to be some European airline hub location, and we hope to have all of the details for the group by the end of the week. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Matu. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Are there any questions regarding timeline? Point taken regarding the conflict with IETF, Avery. I'm afraid given our timelines, it's extremely difficult to adjust in any way. Okay, so moving to the next item, and obviously we'll be providing more details as soon as they emerge on the on these face-to-face meetings. But I think the key message is we're only less than 5 weeks away from our face-to-face meeting where we need to be converging on our proposals. So everyone on deck definitely need to get the work done in a very short time frame before this meeting. Next item is an update on the definitions and scoping document. It's a very short update, don't be afraid. This is just to mention that we have received feedback from several advisors and several of you, actually, on the definition and scoping document. And therefore, we will circulate in the next few days a new version to be discussed. Some of the feedback from the external advisors is rather favorable, yet with a number of very interesting inputs. And so this is going to highlight a small number of questions we have to address. So this is really a heads up. And another information that I want to provide the group is that Jan Art Scholter, who was in Singapore, did suggest that we investigate a little more on the accountability of the accountability mechanism themselves. This is one of the items he put forward in the session on Sunday evening in Singapore, and we as co-chairs confirmed to him that it would be certainly an interesting input for the group to consider if we could elaborate on the best practice in this regard that he has been encountering in his work. So that's something to be expected in the next few weeks that will certainly help us adjust or finalize our proposals to avoid the some comments being made that by adding new layers, the new layers themselves would not be accountable. That's basically what he's suggesting we investigate. So very good engagement with the advisors and very valuable contributions, and please look for be aware we'll circulate a new version with some key discussions highlighted in the next few days. Unless there are questions, we are at top of the hour, so seeing no question, I will turn to Leon for the any other business and concluding remarks. Leon?
Thank you very much, Matthew. This is our final track for this meeting, and I'd like to call for any other business if there's anyone that has business that they'd like to raise at this moment. This is the time. Going once, going twice. Okay, so there are no any other business. So we'd like to thank you all for this excellent meeting, and we have very little time for our next two-phase meeting, and we have a lot of work to do ahead of us. So let's continue work, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.